Okay, we're in the prologue section of the book. This is how we've outlined the book, three easy steps, the introduction before we get to all the speeches of the dialogues. And we covered this last time, a description of Job, his character, where he was from, how the first chapter described him character-wise, how God portrayed him before he started speaking to the devil, and then how he was prosperous, how he was blessed, and we went through all that. His character and action, how he was thoughtful of his children, sacrificing for them in case they had sinned unintentionally in their actions or more so in their thoughts. And then the beginning of the calamities. This was what Job did not see, the interaction between the devil and God, how they had that dialogue one with another. And Satan was slandering him, but God was confident in him. And so they struck a deal, if you will, or came to an agreement that Satan said, well, he'll curse you if you remove all these blessings. And God said, you can have him, you just can't touch him personally. And so Job's world kind of came to a change, didn't it, on one day. And so what Job did see was all that he had. And a point that we made was that impresses me, if you look to verses 13 through 19, is the rapid pace at which all that took place. He just couldn't catch his breath. It just overwhelmed him. And I'm convinced that's what Satan was going for, was just to put it on him so bad and in such a hurry that he'll just react in such a negative way that he'll curse God. But Job did not do that. Job reacted the way that God knew that he would. And the last phrase in chapter 1, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. So Job stood the test. And this proves Satan to be a liar. This is the last chart we got to Wednesday night. Jesus again describing the devil in John 8, verse 44. He's the liar and the father of all lies. And so Satan was not right when they had that first conversation, he and God. Now that gets us to chapter 2. And this is a rather short chapter, just 13 verses long. So let's read now together verses 1 through 6. Matt, if you'll read those for us, please. Job chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. Okay. Some similarities between the beginning of this chapter and what we found in chapter 1. Some of the same statements are made with respect to what God said and what Satan said. And so this chapter begins. Again, this is not what Job saw. He wasn't privy to all this. Another divine summons, I've been calling it, the sons of God, the angels, the servants in the spiritual realm present themselves before the throne of God. Satan is there also. And the Lord asked him the same question as he asked him the first time. Where have you been? And Satan says, well, I'm walking to and fro upon the earth. And like we did last time, we'll again make the reference back to 1 Peter 5 and verse 8. Satan is that roaring lion. He's prowling about, seeking whom he may devour. He was hunting for somebody to overtake or to overwhelm. And Jehovah says, he again then presents Job, my servant Job. So Satan is back for another attempt. He failed the first time. And just as a side comment, how easy does the devil give up? He don't give up, does he? He don't quit. I want to draw your attention to a passage real quickly. This there, again, is 1 Peter 5, verse 8. But look at Luke chapter 4, verse 13 real quickly. Luke's account of the temptations of Christ. Usually we go to Matthew chapter 4, the more familiar one of the two. But look at Luke 4. There's a statement in Luke 4 that Matthew does not record. And I'm not trying to pit one against the other. I'm just saying that the Holy Spirit often does that when there are parallel accounts. But in Luke chapter 4, after the temptations of Christ are over, notice what it says in verse 13 about the devil. Rob, what does it say? What's that? He's looking for a more opportunity. Well, I'm through right now, but I'll be back. He's always looking for a more opportune time. And so this may be the second go-around now. He's back again. He failed the first attempt, but in his mind, well, we'll just crank it up a notch now. So he had it in mind, as we see the discussion then proceeds from what it was the first time to now. He says, oh, but it's skin for skin. Let's just really get down to it, God. All that a man has, he will give up. Is that what he says? For his life. So we took away his family, we took away his possession, we took away his house, all that stuff. But that's not really where a man will put himself. It's you touch him personally. And of course, what was the prohibition the first time around? What had God said? You can't touch him. Now Satan says, let me touch him. And I'll prove to you that he is not the man you think he is, and he will surely curse you to your face. So he's now back for a more opportune time, a more opportune moment. So again, God commends his servant. Again, those three great words, my servant Job. Have you considered him? And I'm asked the question here in question number 7. Look at the statement that is made. And to me, this is interesting. This is what's additional that what we didn't find the first time. In verse 3, after he says, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless, upright man, fearing God and turning from evil. And that's just what he said the first time around. But the difference now in the end of verse 3, and he still holds fast to his integrity, even though what did he say to the devil? Even though what? You incited me against him for no reason. Now, I thought Job's sufferings were for a reason. It was to try or prove his faith. Why would God say for no reason, do you think? Or some versions say without just cause. Maybe your version says that. What do you think Jehovah's got in mind when he says that? Okay, very good. No cause for that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody else? Was Satan's cause just? No, it wasn't fair. Now, can God take that which is unjust and unfair and use it for good purposes? And what do we call that? That's providence. That's providence. We may not see the reason behind it. We may go to our grave not knowing the reason why, but God certainly knows. So this was all instigated by who? By Satan. And it was not a just cause, what he was trying to do. But God's going to use it for good, for the betterment of Job. So see what the devil does. The devil incites God for no just cause. But God, and that's the beauty of His omniscience and His control over everything. He can take that and make it come out for good. And we can't do that because we're limited humans. But God, of course, being who He is, He can do that. So He correctly puts the blame right where it goes. I agree with you the first time, Satan, but you incited me for no cause. And in that statement, how does the commendation of Job shine even greater? Even though you incited me, what's God say about him? What did he do? He still held fast to his integrity. Job is the kind of man that I told you he was. You said he wasn't, but I knew good and well he was. Job is a good man. Really is. Yes, Wayne. That's correct. Yes, because he brought it on himself. You are correct. Very good. All right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So, notice here that God commends Job, but he condemns Satan. I think that's noteworthy. You incited me for no good reason. But I'm commending. I'm still behind my servant Job. He's still the kind of man that I always knew that he was. And he has shown that to you already one time by not doing what you said that he would do. So both a commendation and a condemnation in the same passage, one to the devil and one to a human who was a good servant. All right. Now we have the second challenge. This is verses 4 and 5. This is still in question 7 there. So even though God says what He says, Satan comes right back and says, well, I'll tell you, let's really get down to it. Skin for skin. All that a man has. Another insult, another slander against man by implication. Man is faithful to God as long as he's not afflicted personally. Have you ever known anybody or ever heard of anybody when their health fails, they blame God? That happens. Why is God doing this to me? What have I done to deserve this? Well, whose playbook to get that out of? That comes right out of the devil's playbook. That's what he wants us to do, to blame God. And if we keep believing that, saying that long enough, then eventually what's likely to happen to such a person? He'll wind up doing what? Maybe even cursing God. You become that bitter and that overwhelmed with it. So, another insinuation, another slander, if you will. And so Satan continues, well, skin for skin. You let me touch him. I've taken away all that he owned, but let's make it personal. So now he's directly challenging the very thing God prohibited the first time around. So let me have that. And what does God say? In verse 6. You can have him, but you just can't take his life. And you can stop short of killing him. But was there a limit on the suffering? No. No limit on the suffering. Just a limit. You cannot so afflict him that you wind up taking his life. So again, we see a limitation. So Satan says he'll curse you to your face. So the second test of God grants Satan power over Job's person, yet he is limited in what he can do. Again, 1 Corinthians 10:13, God will not permit us to be tempted or afflicted, if we use the parallel thought, beyond what we're able to endure. So God is able to keep control of that. Yes, Travis. Okay. Yes. Okay. All right. Okay. Very good. All right. Yes, Buford. I don't exactly recall where it is, but in the Gospels, the woman who was what was her condition? She had she was bent on an issue of blood, and said, "Whom Satan hath bound for these 18 years." And I know the passage right off the top of your head that escapes me, but Jesus said, "Whom Satan hath bound." So he attributed that illness or that malady to the devil. And I agree with what Buford says. I think unless we bring it on ourselves, the reason for sickness and pain and suffering in the world can be attributed back to whom ultimately? The devil. I believe he was responsible for all that. That's a good comment. Okay. In question 8, you see all those references there. And I know that with most of them we're skipping way ahead. And we'll get to those texts eventually. But I want to go ahead and present them now because they give us a composite description of just how Job was afflicted this time by Satan, the extent of his condition. Here's what he saw. Job loses his good health. Now, as chapter 2 describes him, what condition is he in? What's on in this time? All right, he has boils from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. I've never had a boil. Anybody here ever had one? Are they pretty painful? All right. Did you have just one? What about Job? I mean, he had them everywhere. And he was in such wretched condition what was it that he could think to do to get relief? Take it. I mean, that's pretty jagged, pretty sharp edge, and he would just scrape himself. Just imagine having to go through that just to find some relief. Yes, before. Just terrible. Had to have been just so terrible. So there he sat, and he tried to relieve himself. But then here are these other references, and if you look these up and made some notes, here's how bad it got for Job, both physically and personally. It made him unrecognizable. In chapter 2 and verse 12, when the friends come, how's it say in verse 12 that when they saw him from afar off, what? They didn't even know who it was. Who is this? I mean, maybe it disfigured him so that they couldn't even tell who it was. So, his flesh bred worms became a hard running sore. Would crust over and then scrape it off and it would run again. And crust over it, just terrible. That's chapter 7 and verse 5. He suffered haunting dreams, get no rest, nightmares. Chapter 7 verse 14 is indicated in the book. He constantly wept. And that's weary. You cry enough, it just wears you out. And so here he was, constantly weeping. Chapter 16, verse 16. His breath became loathsome and caused estrangement from his own wife. Chapter 19, verse 17 gives us that indication. Now she, of course, in this chapter, she will show herself just in a few moments. But still, that brought some kind of a division, an estrangement between him and his wife. Affected his physical breath from his body, all that infection that was inside of him. What else do we learn? He suffered immense physical pain, obviously. That goes without saying. Chapter 19, verse 20. He could not enjoy any rest. Chapter 30, verse 17. And his skin became black and suffered internal burning sensations. Chapter 30 and verse 30. All these indications are given to us in the book. I think that was the last reference. That's how he was suffering. So it wasn't like he had a head cold. Or a hangnail. You know, I mean, he was really, really suffering. So when Satan proposes this to God and God puts him in his hand, just how bad did Satan afflict him? Well, he's pouring it on him. Really letting him have it, isn't he? He really is letting him have it. Look at Job. Very good point. Okay, so in addition to physical suffering, now we get to verse 9. Here we have some emotional trauma. It gets worse. Adding that old saying of ours, we add insult to injury. And it's never a bad time to have to suffer emotional pain like that. I'm sorry, it's never a good time to have to suffer that, but boy, of all times now, for him to have to hear this from somebody that he loves, here's what he hears from his wife. Verse 9 of chapter 2. We stopped in verse 6 a while ago. Let's finish the chapter now. Let's just go 7 through 10. Verses 7 through 10. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. He took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, the middle part of question 8, who was it that turned out to be a tremendous disappointment to him? His wife. Think of all the things that a man and a woman share together when they're married. I mean, they have imagine hearing that. Yeah, this would be awful. So that had to have hurt Job so deeply for his wife to hear, or for his wife to say that. So his own wife ridiculed his integrity. And Job Maybe she's saying, I love you so much, I see you're in so much pain, you'd be better off dead. Now some have reasoned, yes, sir. This is a tough moment. I understand that. Yes, Buford. I think that's a good distinction to make. And this kind of touches what Harold just said. It's not that you want your mate to suffer. Obviously not. And maybe some have suggested that she is herself speaking out of her own grief. Who was it that died in the first chapter? Maybe those children were hers. Now, I'm not trying to start an argument here. If we're correct about the dating of the book, this was in the days of the patriarchs, which was the days of polygamy. So Job may have had more than one wife. We don't know, and I'm not going to speculate any farther than that. I'm just saying maybe those weren't all her children. Maybe they were. If they were her children, then she lost 10 children too. And maybe her own grief is talking. We're saying a lot of maybes here. And I'm just saying, no matter the reason, is it ever a reason to curse God? Never a reason to do that. We can't give up that. We just can't. And Harold makes a good point. We don't want to sit in judgment of her, because I've never been faced with that situation. To watch someone that I love dearly, my wife or my children, suffer. I can't imagine what that's like. I know maybe some of you all have been in that situation. I'm sure it's tough. I think we would agree on that. But she nonetheless, this advice that she gives Job, whose message is that? That's the devil's message. So in a roundabout way, and again, she wasn't privy either to the conversation between God and Satan. She didn't know about that either. But her advice to Job is falling in line with the devil's idea about it, and not God's. And I guess what we need to say is, never, ever do we have reason, good reason. We may have a reason, it's not proper thinking, but we never have the reason to just give up on God totally and curse Him and then take the fallout. Yes, Charles? He's attacking that concept. You are correct. So his own wife speaks things that had to have cut Job pretty deeply, the advice that she gives him. So sometimes, the lesson I think here is, and this is the last part of of a question out here. Sometimes Satan, and this shows us just how low he'll stoop. Look at Matthew 10, verses 32 through 39. And we're starting in verse 32, not verse 34, but verse 32, because Jesus actually begins that discussion there by saying, "Whoever therefore will confess me before men, him I'll confess before my Father who's in heaven. But he who denies me before men." What was Satan wanting Job to do here? Deny God. And then after saying those two verses, now we get to verse 34. Jesus is talking about being worthy of Him. He who loves what people did He say more than me is not worthy of Him. Who did He talk about? Family. Father, mother, son, daughter. You could throw husband and wife in there too. I did not come to bring peace, but I came to bring a sword. And a man's foes will be those of his own house. And so sometimes Satan will use those whom we love the most in such a despicable way to try to get us to renounce God and go against God's will for us. I believe that's what's happening here. Satan's using them. Now some commentators, I don't know if they say this in jest or not, but someone I read said, "Well, I wonder why Satan didn't take her in the first chapter. Why was she spared?" Well, I don't know. he wound up using her because of what she said. That may or may not be so. I don't know that either. But here we have those. She is saying, and Job had to hear it. And I'm sure it just really, really hit him hard when she said that. But even in his suffering, he's still thinking, right, isn't he? His thoughts are still there. And when she said that, what did he? How did he reply to that? "Now, sweetheart, that's foolish. We cannot think that way. You speak as one of the foolish women speak." And then the absolutely right question to ask. What did he say, Trevor? "Now, if we're going to take the good, and we all want the good. I mean, nobody here is arguing, well, I'm tired of all these blessings. I'm tired of all this prosperity. But if we want our hand out for that, it's a two-sided coin. You've got to also be open and willing to receive what? The bad. And the bad's going to come. So, we've got to be fair about this."
It makes you wonder if when all this was happening, was he in a way that she would know that he wished that he would die? And then they, you know, said, "Well, here's the way out." I mean, I don't think she was thinking about Job's peace of mind at all when she said, "Curse God and die." But that would be a way he would die. But he's not going to do that. He'd be willing to die, all right, but not that way.
Well, in fact, in chapter 3, if we'll get to it just in a few moments, he didn't want to live anymore. That's obvious. But her way is not the right way to go about doing that, obviously. So sometimes Satan will tempt us to do evil through those that we love the most. And I believe that's the case here in Job chapter 2. All right. So his response to his wife is in verse 10. Her advice was foolish. And it was harmonizing with what Satan said to do. And that's not the answer, obviously. We can't do that. So his reasoning was true. And I want to pull in these New Testament passages here real quick. Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. And once you find that, then flip over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And these are two well-known passages. And I believe talking about them here would be on point. Romans chapter 8. Brother Lambert, read verse 18 for us.
"For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us."
That's about the truth of it, isn't it? I mean, that's how Job was thinking, obviously. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. Rob, if you have that, would you read that for us? Through verse 18.
"Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outer man is perishing, yet the inner man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us as far more exceeding an external weight of glory, while we do not look on the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, the things which are not seen are eternal.
Now, just a couple of quick observations, and then we'll get back to Job. But I do think these are worthy of our consideration. The challenge is verse 17. How do we have to view these sufferings? Now, what's the words that the Holy Spirit used? Light and momentary. That's the challenge.
Think about Paul. If we consider what happened to him, how could it be light?
Right. Now, of course, it is light or momentary in what sense? Compared to eternity. That's why it's light and momentary, because it's compared to eternity. And the other challenge for us is in verse 18. Where do we have to look? We don't look where? At what we see. We can't look at it. We can't dwell on that. Now, that's easy to do that, I know, isn't it? But the challenge is we have to dig deep for character and for strength and for integrity, and not look at the things which are seen, but look at the things which are not seen. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. You are right. Well, so far, back to Job, that's what he's doing when he rejects this counsel of his wife. And I know one thing, he may be losing his health, and he has, but he's not lost his critical thinking. He's still thinking right. We cannot do that. I must not do that. It's not worth that. So, again, back in Job, and the last part of verse 10 says, in all this Job did not sin with his lips. He did not curse God. He didn't blame God. He's still a great man of integrity, and one that's worthy to hold up for an example. All right. Before we get to the next three verses in chapter 2, any other thoughts or comments down through verse 10 of chapter 2? Anything that you thought of that you want to bring out? Yes, Trevor. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it wasn't too fast for those comments. That was a good observation. Satan's unscrupulous. He'll use anybody. Yes, Harold. That's right. Very good. That's correct. Yes, Buford. Of chapter 2? Well, it may just be that the second quote unquote from God, though not stated, is just understood. Again, I don't think that. Well, if he's not saying it here, and I don't believe that he is, there are several statements in the speeches that will follow that Job did accuse God somewhat of bringing this on him. Yes, that is true. God, in His providential rule of everything, allows whatever happens to happen. But Job did utter some statements, and we'll get to them, where it sounds to me pretty much like he's saying, God, you're doing this.
That's the reason he said
later
on.
I retract what I said. He said some unwise things. And we'll get to those. Okay. In the time we've got left, let's start this last section, the arrival of the three friends. Look at their joint decision. Now, they do not come from the same area. Eliphaz the Temanite, some have rendered him possibly he could have been one of the sons of Esau, who was named Teman. Genesis 36, verse 11. Bildad the Shuhite, possible descendant of Abraham and Keturah, Genesis 25 and verse 2, but he is from Shua. And then Zophar the Naamathite, we have no information about that in the Scripture, but they are three different ites. They come from three different places. And so it wasn't like they lived together in the same place and then they came together. They had each heard of Job's condition. And that's stated for us there in verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all his adversity that each came upon him, that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. And so they made a joint decision to each come from their own home and possibly meet somewhere and then let's go comfort our friend Job. Well, that was their joint decision. That's in verse 11 for us. So they'd each heard of Job's sufferings and they came to sympathize with him and to comfort him. That's good friends. Good friends. To decide to do something like that. However, look now at their joint actions. And I still commend them on this basis, starting in verse 12. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance, they did not recognize him. And so what did they do? They wept. So the joint actions, they wept and mourned with him, the Bible says. And they sat down in silence with him for how long? Imagine that, sitting there, the four of them, and nobody says a word. Not one word is uttered for a whole week. Let me offer a lesson or a point. Sometimes one of the best things we can do if we want to comfort somebody is just be there and don't say a word. Just our presence can be helpful. Can be so helpful. Just to have that person who's suffering know. Even if you've come from a great distance or you've come at great expense to you and not just monetary expense but time-wise. But you're investing something in somebody who's really suffering. It can be great comfort just to sit there and not say a word. Hold a hand, put an arm around the shoulder. That's comforting. And so these men, I have no doubt that they came to comfort. That was their idea in the first place. But the sad reality about them is, though they came to comfort, what they wind up doing? They wind up condemning him by what they said. So their presence meant more than their words. Because what they had to say was off base. They were reasoning incorrectly, as we'll get to the speeches.
Job says that. You ought to be pitied.
Yes, that's right. He says a lot of things to them. In fact, one passage that I quote a lot of times just in jest, he says, My friends, miserable comforters, are you all? You're not helping me. It's actually making me feel worse. Okay. That takes us to the end of chapter 2. And our time is up. Any last comments or questions? Anybody? We've had a good discussion this morning. That's right. And just sit there. And they would have been such a great help to them, but they didn't stop with that. Yes, sir.